and Angela in the shade of a tree with low-hanging branches. It was hard for me to listen as they talked about prom and about how Lacey was feuding with Becca or whatever. I was waiting for a chance to tell them what I'd seen. But then, when I had the chance, when I finally said, I took a pretty long look at the two pseudovisions, but didn't find much. I realized that there was nothing new to say, really. No one even seemed that concerned, except Lacey. She shook her head as I talked about the pseudovisions, and then she said, I was reading online last night that people who are suicidal end relationships with people they're angry with, and they give away their stuff. Margot gave me like 5 pairs of jeans last week because she said I could wear them better, which isn't even true because she's so much more, like, curvy. I liked Lacey, but I saw Margot's point about the undermining. Something about telling us that story made her start to cry, and Ben put an arm around her, and she tucked her head into his shoulder, which was hard to do because in her heels she was actually taller than him. Lacey, we just have to find a location. I mean, talk to your friends. Did she ever mention paper towns? Did she ever talk about a specific place? Was there some subdivision somewhere that meant something to her? She shrugged into Ben's shoulder. Bro, don't push her, Ben said. I sighed, but shut up. I'm on the online stuff, Radar said. But her username hasn't logged onto Omnictionary since she left. And then, all at once, they were back on the topic of prom. Lacey emerged from Ben's shoulder, still looking sad and distracted, but she tried to smile as Radar and Ben swapped tales of corsage purchasing. The day passed as it always did, in slow motion, with 1,000 plaintive glances at the clock. But now it was even more unbearable, because every minute I wasted in school was another minute in which I failed to find her. My only vaguely interesting class that day was English, when Dr. Holden completely ruined Moby Dick for me by incorrectly assuming we had all read it and talking about Captain Ahab and his obsession with finding and killing this white whale. But it was fun to watch her get more and more excited as she talked. Ahab's a madman railing against fate. You never see Ahab wanting anything else in this whole novel, do you? He has a singular obsession, and because he is the captain of his ship, no one can stop him. You can argue, indeed you may argue if you choose to write about him for your final reaction papers, that Ahab is a fool for being obsessed. But you could also argue that there is something tragically heroic about fighting this battle he is doomed to lose. Is Ahab's hope a kind of insanity, or is it the very definition of humanness? I wrote down as much as I could of what she said, realizing that I could probably pull off my final reaction paper without actually reading the book. As she talked, it occurred to me that Dr. Holden was unusually good at reading stuff, and she had said she liked Whitman. So, when the bell rang, I took leaves of grass from my bag and then zipped it back up slowly while everyone raced off either to home or to extracurriculars. I waited behind someone asking for an extension on an already late paper, and then he left. "It's my favorite Whitman reader," she said. I forced a smile. "Do you know Margot Roth Spiegelman?" I asked. She sat down behind her desk and motioned for me to sit. "I never had her in class," Dr. Holden said, "but I've certainly heard of her. I know that she ran away. She sort of left me this book of poems before she, disappeared." I handed the book over, and Dr. Holden began paging through it slowly. As she did, I told her, "I've been thinking a lot about the highlighted parts. If you go to the end of Song of Myself, she highlights this stuff about dying, like, if you want me again, look for me under your boot soles." "She left this for you," Dr. Holden said quietly. "Yeah," I said. She flipped back and tapped at the green highlighted quote with her fingernail. "What is this about the door jams? That's a great moment in the poem where Whitman, I mean, you can feel him shouting at you, open the doors. In fact, remove the doors." "She actually left me something else inside my door jam." Dr. Holden laughed. "Wow, clever, but it's such a great poem. I hate to see it reduced to such a literal reading. And she seems to have responded very darkly to what is finally a very optimistic poem. The poem is about our connectedness, each of us sharing the same root system like leaves of grass." "But, I mean, from what she highlighted, it seems kind of like a suicide note," I said. Dr. Holden read the last stanzas again and then looked up at me. What a mistake it is to distill this poem into something hopeless. I hope that's not the case, Quentin. If you read the whole poem, I don't see how you can come to any conclusion except that life is sacred and valuable, but who knows? Maybe she skimmed it for what she was looking for. We often read poems that way. But if so, she completely misunderstood what Whitman was asking of her. And what's that? She closed the book and looked right at me in a way that made it impossible for me to hold her gaze. What do you think of it? I don't know, I said, staring at a stack of graded papers on her desk. I've tried to read it straight through a bunch of times, but I haven't gotten very far. Mostly I just read the parts she highlighted. I'm reading it to try to understand Margot, not to try to understand Whitman. She picked up a pencil and wrote something on the back of an envelope. Hold on, I'm writing that down. What? What you just said, she explained. Why? Because I think that is precisely what Whitman would have wanted. For you to see Song of Myself not just as a poem, but as a way into understanding another. But I wonder if maybe you have to read it as a poem, instead of just reading these fragments for quotes and clues. I do think there are some interesting connections between the poet in Song of Myself and Margot Spiegelman, all that wild charisma and wanderlust. But a poem can't do its work if you only read snippets of it. Okay, thanks, I said. I took the book and stood up. I didn't feel much better. I got a ride home with Ben that afternoon and stayed at his house until he left to go pick up Radar for some pre-prom party being thrown by our friend Jake, whose parents were out of town. Ben asked me to go, but I didn't feel like it. I walked back to my house, across the park where Margot and I had found the dead guy. I remembered that morning, and I felt something twist at my gut in the remembering of it. Not because of the dead guy, but because I remembered that she had found him first. Even in my own neighborhood's playground, I had been unable to find a body on my own. How the hell would I do it now? I tried to read Song of Myself again when I got home that night, but despite Dr. Holden's advice, it still turned into a jumble of nonsensical words. I woke up early the next morning, just after 8, and went to the computer. Ben was online, so I IM'd him. Cue the resurrection. How was the party? It was a kidney infection. Lame, of course. Every party I go to is lame. Cue the resurrection. Sorry I missed it. You're up early. Want to come over, play resurrection? It was a kidney infection.
You kidding?
Cue the resurrection.
No.
It was a kidney infection.
Do you know what day it is?
Cue the resurrection. Saturday, May 15th? It was a kidney infection.
Bro, prom starts in 11 hours and 14 minutes. I have to pick Lacey up in less than 9 hours. I haven't even washed and waxed Rawpaw yet, which, by the way, you did a nice job of dirtying up. Then after that, I have to shower and shave and trim nasal hairs and wash and wax myself. God, don't even get me started. I have a lot to do. Listen, I'll call you later if I have a chance.
Radar was on too, so I IM'd him. Cue the resurrection.
What is Ben's problem?
I'm Nictionary in 96.
Whoa there, cowboy.
Cue the resurrection.
Sorry, I'm just pissed that he thinks prom is oh so important.
I'm Nictionary in 96.
You're going to be pretty pissed when you hear that the only reason I'm up this early is that I really need to go because I have to pick up my tux, aren't you?
Cue the resurrection.
Jesus Christ, seriously?
I'm Nictionary in 96.
Cue... Tomorrow and the next day and the day after that and all the days for the rest of my life, I am happy to participate in your investigation. But I have a girlfriend. She wants to have a nice prom. I want to have a nice prom. It's not my fault that Margot Roth Spiegelman didn't want us to have a nice prom. I didn't know what to say. He was right, maybe. Maybe she deserved to be forgotten. But at any rate, I couldn't forget her.
My mom and dad were still in bed, watching an old movie on TV.
Can I take the minivan? I asked.
Sure, why?
Decided to go to prom, I answered hurriedly.
The lie occurred to me as I told it.
Gotta pick out a tux and then get over to Ben's. We're both going stag.
My mom sat up smiling.
Well, I think that's great, hon. It'll be great for you. Will you come back so we can take pictures? Mom, do you really need pictures of me going to prom stag? I mean, hasn't my life been humiliating enough?
She laughed. Call before curfew, my dad said, which was midnight.
Sure thing, I said. It was so easy to lie to them that I found myself wondering why I'd never much done it before that night with Margot. I took I-4 west toward Kissimmee and the theme parks, and then past I-Drive where Margot and I had broken into SeaWorld, and then took Highway 27 down toward Haines City. There are a lot of lakes down there, and wherever there are lakes in Florida, there are rich people to congregate around them, so it seemed an unlikely place for a pseudo-vision. But the website I had found had been very specific about there being this huge parcel of oft-foreclosed land that no one had ever managed to develop. I recognized the place immediately, because every other subdivision on the access road was walled in, whereas Quail Hollow was just a plastic sign hammered into the ground. As I turned in, little plastic posters read, "For Sale," "Prime Location," and "Great Development Opportunities," and the final S was a dollar sign. Unlike the previous pseudo-visions, someone was keeping up Quail Hollow. No houses had been built, but the lots were marked with surveying stakes, and the grass was freshly mown. All the streets were paved and named with road signs. In the subdivision center, a perfectly circular lake had been dug and then, for some reason, drained. As I drove up in the minivan, I could see it was about 10 feet deep and several hundred feet in diameter. A hose snaked across the bottom of the crater to the middle, where a steel and aluminum fountain rose from the bottom to eye level. I found myself feeling thankful the lake was empty, so I wouldn't have to stare into the water and wonder if she was in the bottom somewhere, expecting me to put on scuba gear to find her. I felt certain Margot could not be in Quail Hollow. It abutted too many subdivisions for it to be a good place to hide, whether you were a person or a body. But I looked anyway, and as I idled down the streets in the minivan, I felt so hopeless. I wanted to be happy that it wasn't here. But if it wasn't Quail Hollow, it would be the next place, or the one after that, or the one after that. Or maybe I'd never find her. Was that the better fate? I finished my rounds, finding nothing, and headed back toward the highway. I got lunch at a drive-thru and then ate as I drove out west toward the mini-mall. Chapter 12. As I pulled into the mini-mall parking lot, I noticed that blue painter's tape had been used to seal our hole in the board. I wondered who could have been there after us. I drove around to the back and parked the minivan next to a rusted dumpster that hadn't encountered a garbage truck in decades. I figured I could bust through the painter's tape if I needed to, and I was walking around toward the front when I noticed that the steel back doors to the stores didn't have any visible hinges. I had learned a thing or two about hinges, thanks to Margot, and I realized why we hadn't had any luck pulling on all those doors. They opened in. I walked up to the door to the mortgage company office and pushed. It opened with no resistance whatsoever. God, we were such idiots. Surely whoever cared for the building knew about the unlocked door, which made the painter's tape seem even more out of place. I wiggled out of the backpack I had packed that morning and pulled out my dad's high-powered mag light and flashed it around the room. Something sizable in the rafters scurried. I shivered. Little lizards jump ran through the path of the light. A single shaft of light from a hole in the ceiling shone in the front corner of the room, and sunlight peeked out from behind the particle board, but I mostly relied on the flashlight. I walked up and down the rows of desks, looking at the items we had found in the drawers, which we had left. It was profoundly creepy to see desktop after desktop with the same unmarked calendar. February 1986. February 1986. February 1986. June 1986. February 1986. I spun around and shone the light on a desk in the very center of the room. The calendar had been changed to June. I leaned in close and looked at the paper of the calendar, hoping to see a jagged edge where previous months had been torn off, or some marks on the page where a pen had pushed through the paper, but there was nothing different from the other calendars, save the date. With the flashlight crooked between my neck and shoulder, I started to look through desk drawers again, paying special attention to the June desk. Some napkins, some still-sharp pencils, memos about mortgages addressed to one Dennis McMahon, an empty pack of Marlboro Lights, and an almost full bottle of red nail polish. I took the flashlight in one hand and the nail polish in the other and stared at it closely. So red, it was almost black. I had seen this color before. It had been on the minivan's dash that night. Suddenly, the scurrying in the rafters and the creaking in the building became irrelevant. I felt a perverted euphoria. I couldn't know if it was the same bottle, of course, but it was certainly the same color. I rotated the bottle around and saw, unambiguously, a tiny smear of blue spray paint on the outside of the bottle. From her spray-painted fingers. I could be sure now. She had been here after we parted ways that morning. Maybe she was still staying here. Maybe she only showed up late at night. Maybe she had taped up the particle board to keep her privacy. I resolved right then to stay until morning. If Margot had slept here, I could too, and thus commenced a brief conversation with myself. Me. But the rats. Me. Yeah, but they seem to stay in the ceiling. Me. But the lizards. Me. Oh, come on. You used to pull their tails off when you were little. You're not scared of lizards. Me. But the rats. Me. Rats can't really hurt you anyway. They're more scared of you than you are of them. Me. Okay, but what about the rats? Me. Shut up. In the end, the rats didn't matter, not really, because I was in a place where Margot had been alive. I was in a place that saw her after I did, and the warmth of that made the mini-mall almost comfortable. I mean, I didn't feel like an infant being held by mommy or anything, but my breath had stopped catching each time I heard a noise. And in becoming comfortable, I found it easier to explore. I knew there was more to find, and now I felt ready to find it. I left the office, ducking through a troll hole into the room with the labyrinthine shelves. I walked up and down the aisles for a while. At the end of the room, I crawled through the next troll hole into the empty room. I sat down on the carpet rolled against the far wall. The cracked white paint crunched against my back. I stayed there for a while, long enough that the jagged beam of light coming through a hole in the ceiling crept an inch along the floor as I let myself become accustomed to the sounds. After a while, I got bored and crawled through the last troll hole into the souvenir shop. I rifled through the t-shirts. I pulled the box of tourist brochures out from under the display case and looked through them, looking for some hand-scrawled message from Margot, but I found nothing. I returned to the room I now found myself calling the library. I thumbed through the Reader's Digest and found a stack of National Geographics from the 1960s, but the box was covered in so much dust that I knew Margot had never been inside it. I began to find evidence of human habitation only when I got back to the empty room. On the wall with the rolled-up carpet, I discovered 9 thumbtack holes in the cracked and paint-peeled wall. 4 of the holes made an approximate square, and then there were 5 holes inside the square. I thought perhaps Margot had stayed here long enough to hang up some posters, although there were none obviously missing from her room when we searched it. I unrolled the carpet partway and immediately found something else, a flattened, empty box that had once contained 24 nutrition bars. I found myself able to imagine Margot here, leaning against the wall with musty rolled-up carpet for a seat, eating a nutrition bar. She is all alone, with only this to eat. Maybe she drives once a day to a convenience store to buy a sandwich and some Mountain Dew, but most of every day is spent here, on or near this carpet. This image seemed too sad to be true. It all struck me as so lonely and so very un-Margot. But all the evidence of the past 10 days accumulated toward a surprising conclusion. Margot herself was, at least part of the time, very un-Margot. I rolled out the carpet farther and found a blue knit blanket, almost newspaper thin. I grabbed it and held it to my face, and there, God, yes, her smell. The lilac shampoo and the almond in her skin lotion, and beneath all of it the faint sweetness of the skin itself. And I could picture her again. She unravels the carpet halfway each night so her hip isn't against bare concrete as she lies on her side. She crawls beneath the blanket, uses the rest of the carpet as a pillow, and sleeps. But why here? How is this better than home? And if it's so great, why leave? These are the things I cannot imagine, and I realize that I cannot imagine them because I didn't know Margot. I knew how she smelled, and I knew how she acted in front of me, and I knew how she acted in front of others, and I knew that she liked Mountain Dew and adventure and dramatic gestures, and I knew that she was funny and smart and just generally more than the rest of us. But I didn't know what brought her here, or what kept her here, or what made her leave. I didn't know why she owned thousands of records but never told anyone she even liked music. I didn't know what she did at night with the shades down, with the door locked, in the sealed privacy of her room. And maybe this was what I needed to do above all. I needed to discover what Margot was like when she wasn't being Margot. I lay there with the her-scented blanket for a while, staring up at the ceiling. I could see a sliver of late afternoon sky through a crack in the roof, like a jagged canvas painted a bright blue. This would be the perfect place to sleep. One could see stars at night without getting rained on. I called my parents to check in. My dad answered, and I said we were in the car on the way to meet Radar and Angela, and that I was staying with Ben overnight. He told me not to drink, and I told him I wouldn't, and he said he was proud of me for going to prom, and I wondered if he would be proud of me for doing what I was actually doing. This place was boring. I mean, once you got past the rodents and the mysterious, the building is falling apart groans in the walls, there wasn't anything to do. No internet, no TV, no music. I was bored, so it again confused me that she would pick this place, since Margot always struck me as a person with very limited tolerance for boredom. Maybe she liked the idea of slumming it? Unlikely. Margot wore designer jeans to break into SeaWorld. It was the lack of alternative stimuli that led me back to Song of Myself, the only certain gift I had from her. I moved to a water-stained patch of concrete floor, directly beneath the hole in the ceiling, sat down cross-legged, and angled my body so the light shone upon the book. And for some reason, finally, I could read it. The thing is that the poem starts out really slowly. It's just sort of a long introduction. But around the 90th line, Whitman finally starts to tell a bit of a story, and that's where it picked up for me. So Whitman is sitting around, which he calls loafing, on the grass, and then a child said, "What is the grass?" fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. There was the hope Dr. Holden had talked about. The grass was a metaphor for his hope. But that's not all. He continues. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer designedly dropped. Like grass is a metaphor for God's greatness or something. Or I guess the grass is itself a child. And then soon after that, or I guess it is a uniform hieroglyphic, and it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks as among white. So maybe the grass is a metaphor for our equality and our essential connectedness, as Dr. Holden had said. And then finally, he says of grass, and now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. So grass is death, too. It grows out of our buried bodies. The grass was so many different things at once, it was bewildering. So grass is a metaphor for life and for death and for equality and for connectedness and for children and for God and for hope. I couldn't figure out which of these ideas, if any, was at the core of the poem. But thinking about the grass and all the different ways you can see it made me think about all the ways I'd seen and misseen Margot. There was no shortage of ways to see her. I had been focused on what had become of her, but now, with my head trying to understand the multiplicity of grass and her smell from the blankets still in my throat, I realized that the most important question was who I was looking for. If "what is the grass" has such a complicated answer, I thought so too must "who is Margot Roth-Spiegelman?" Like a metaphor rendered incomprehensible by its ubiquity, there was room enough in what she had left for me for endless imaginings, for an infinite set of Margots. I had to narrow her down, and I figured there had to be things here that I was seeing wrong or not seeing. I wanted to tear off the roof and light up the whole place so that I could see it all at once instead of one flashlight beam at a time. I put aside Margot's blanket and shouted loud enough for all the rats to hear, "I am going to find something here!" I went through each desk in the office again, but it seemed more and more obvious that Margot had used only the desk with the nail polish in the drawer and the calendar set to June. I ducked through a troll hole and made my way back to the library, walking again through the abandoned metal shelves. On each shelf, I looked for dustless shapes that would tell me Margot had used this space for something, but I couldn't find any. But then, my darting flashlight happened across something atop the shelf in a corner of the room, right near the boarded-up storefront window. It was the spine of a book. The book was called Roadside America, Your Travel Guide, and had been published in 1998, after this place had been abandoned. I flipped through it with the flashlight crooked between neck and shoulder. The book listed hundreds of attractions you could visit, from the world's largest ball of twine in Darwin, Minnesota, to the world's largest ball of stamps in Omaha, Nebraska. someone had folded down the corners of several seemingly random pages. The book wasn't too dusty. Maybe SeaWorld was only the first stop on some kind of whirlwind adventure. Yes, that made sense. That was Margot. She found out about this place somehow, came here to gather her supplies, spent a night or two, and then hit the road. I could imagine her pinballing among tourist traps. As the last light fled from the holes in the ceiling, I found more books above other bookshelves. The Rough Guide to Nepal, The Great Sights of Canada, America by Carr, Fedor's Guide to the Bahamas, Let's Go Bhutan. There seemed to be no connection at all among the books except that they were all about traveling and had all been published after the mini-mall was abandoned. I tucked the mag light under my chin, scooped up the books into a stack that extended from my waist to my chest, and carried them into the empty room I was now imagining as the bedroom. So it turned out that I did spend prom night with Margot, just not quite as I had dreamed. Instead of busting into prom together, I sat against her rolled-up carpet with a ratty blanket draped over my knees, alternately reading travel guides by flashlight and sitting still in the dark as the cicadas hummed above and around me. Maybe she had sat here in the cacophonous darkness and felt some kind of desperation take her over, and maybe she found it impossible to unthink the thought of death. I could imagine that, of course. But I could also imagine this. Margot picking these books up at various garage sales, buying every travel guide she could get her hands on for a quarter or less, and then coming here, even before she disappeared, to read the books away from prying eyes. Reading them, trying to decide on destinations. Yes, she would stay on the road and in hiding, a balloon floating through the sky, eating up hundreds of miles a day with the help of a perpetual tailwind. And in this imagining, she was alive. Had she brought me here to give me the clues to piece together an itinerary? Maybe. Of course, I was nowhere near an itinerary. Judging from the books, she could be in Jamaica, or Namibia, Topeka, or Beijing. But I had only just begun to look. Chapter 13. In my dream, her head was on my shoulder as I lay on my back, only the corner of carpet between us and the concrete floors. Her arm was around my ribcage. We were just lying there, sleeping. God help me, the only teenaged guy in America who dreams of sleeping with girls and just sleeping with them. And then my phone rang. It took two more rings before my fumbling hands found the phone lying on the unrolled carpet. It was 3:18 a.m. Ben was calling. "Good morning, Ben," I said.
"Yes!"
he answered, screaming, and I could tell right away that now was not the time to try to explain to him all I had learned and imagined about Margot. I could damn near smell the booze on his breath. That one word, in the way it was shouted, contained more exclamation points than anything Ben had ever said to me in his entire life. "I take it prom is going well?"
"Yes! Quentin Jacobson! The Q! America's greatest Quentin! Yes!"
His voice got distant then, but I could still hear him.
"Everybody! Hey! Shut up! Hold on! Shut up! Quentin Jacobson is inside my phone!"
There was a cheer then, and Ben's voice returned.
"Yes! Quentin! Yes! Bro, you have got to come over here!"
"Where is here?" I asked.
"Becca's! Do you know where it is?"
As it happened, I knew precisely where it was. I had been in her basement. "I know where it is, but it's the middle of the night, Ben, and I'm in..."
"Yes! You have to come! Right now! Right now!"
"Ben, there are more important things going on," I answered.
"Designated driver!"
"What?"
"You're my designated driver. Yes, you are so designated. I love that you answered. That is so awesome. I have to be home by 6, and I designate you to get me there. Yes!"
"Can't you just spend the night there?" I asked.
"No! Boo! Boo on Quentin! Hey, everybody! Boo Quentin!"
And then I was booed.
"Everybody's drunk.
Ben drunk. Lacey drunk. Radar drunk. Nobody drive. Home by 6. Promise, Mom.
Boo sleepy Quentin. Yay, designated driver. Yes!"
I took a long breath, If Margot were going to show up, she would have showed up by 3. I'll be there in half an hour.
Yes, 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 yes.
Ben was still making assertions of affirmation when I hung up the phone. I lay there for a moment, telling myself to get up, and then I did. Still half asleep, I crawled through troll holes past the library and into the office, then pulled open the back door and got into the minivan. I turned into Becca Arrington's subdivision just before 4. There were dozens of cars parked along both sides of Becca's street, and I knew there would be more people inside since many of them had been dropped off via limo. I found a spot a couple of cars away from Rawpaw. I had never seen Ben drunk. In 10th grade, I once drank a bottle of pink wine at a band party. It tasted as bad going down as it did coming up. It was Ben who sat with me in Cassie Heine's Winnie the Pooh-themed bathroom while I projectile vomited pink liquid all over a painting of Eeyore. I think the experience soured both of us on alcoholic pursuits. Until tonight, anyway. Now, I knew Ben was going to be drunk. I had heard him on the phone. No sober person says yes that many times per minute. Nonetheless, when I pushed past some people smoking cigarettes on Becca's front lawn and opened the door to her house, I did not expect to see Jace Worthington and 2 other baseball players holding a tuxedo-clad Ben upside down above a keg of beer. The spout of the beer keg was in Ben's mouth, and the entire room was transfixed on him. They were all chanting in unison, 18, 19, 20! And for a moment, I thought Ben was getting, like, hazed or something. But no, as he sucked on the beer spout like it was mother's milk, little trickles of beer spilled from the sides of his mouth because he was smiling. 23, 24, 25, the people shouted, and you could hear their enthusiasm. Apparently something remarkable was taking place. It all seemed so trivial, so embarrassing. It all seemed like paper kids having their paper fun. I made my way through the crowd toward Ben and was surprised to happen across Radar and Angela. What the hell is this? I asked. Radar paused from counting and looked over at me.
Yes, he said. The designated driver cometh. Yes. Why is everyone saying yes so much tonight? Good question, Angela shouted to me.
She puffed out her cheeks and sighed. She looked almost as annoyed as I felt.
Hell yes, it's a good question,
Radar said, holding a red plastic cup full of beer in each hand.
They're both his,
Angela explained to me calmly.
Why aren't you designated driver?
I asked.
They wanted you, she said. Thought it would get you here.
I rolled my eyes. She rolled hers back sympathetically.
You must really like him,
I said, nodding toward Radar, who was holding both beers over his head, joining in the counting. Everybody seemed so proud of the fact that they could count.
Even now, he's sort of adorable, she answered.
Gross, I said. Radar nudged me with one of the beer cups.
Look at our boy Ben. He's some kind of autistic savant when it comes to keg stands. Apparently he's like setting a world record right now or something.
What is a keg stand? I asked. Angela pointed at Ben.
That,
she said. Oh, I said. Well, how hard can it be to hang upside down?
Apparently, the longest keg stand in Winter Park history is 62 seconds, she explained, and it was set by Tony Yorick,
who's this gigantic guy who had graduated when we were freshmen and now played for the University of Florida football team. I was all for Ben setting records, but I couldn't bring myself to join in as everyone shouted, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63! And then Ben pulled the spout out of his mouth and screamed,
yes! I must be the greatest! I shook up the world!
Jace and some baseball players flipped him right side up and carried him around on their shoulders. And then Ben caught sight of me, pointed, and let out the loudest and most passionate,
yes!
I'd ever heard. Soccer players don't get that excited about winning the World Cup. Ben jumped off the baseball player's shoulders, landing in an awkward crouch, and then swayed a bit on his way to standing. He wrapped his arm around my shoulders.
Yes!
He said again.
Quentin is here! the great man. Let's hear him for Quentin, the best friend of the fucking keg stand world record holder.
Jace rubbed the top of my head and said,
"You're the man, Q."
And then I heard radar in my ear.
"By the way, we are like folk heroes, these people. Angela and I left our after party to come here because Ben told me I'd be greeted as a king. I mean, they were chanting my name. Apparently, they all think Ben is hilarious or something, and so they like us, too."
To Radar, and also to everyone else, I said, "Wow." Ben turned away from us, and I watched him grab Cassie Heine. His hands were on her shoulders, and she put her hands on his shoulders, and he said,
"My prom day was almost prom queen."
And Cassie said,
"I know, that's great."
And Ben said,
"I wanted to kiss you every single day for the last 3 years.
And Cassie said,
"I think you should."
And then Ben said,
"Yes! That's awesome!"
But he didn't kiss Cassie. He just turned around to me and said,
"Cassie wants to kiss me."
And I said, "Yeah." And he said,
"That's so awesome!"
And then he seemed to forget about Cassie and me both, as if the idea of kissing Cassie Heine felt better than actually kissing her ever could. Cassie said to me,
"This party is so great, isn't it?"
And I said, "Yeah." And she said,
"This is like the opposite of band parties, huh?"
And I said, "Yeah." And she said,
"Ben is a spaz, but I love him."
And I said, "Yeah.
Plus, he's got really green eyes,"
she added. And I said, "Uh-huh." And then she said,
"Everyone says you're cuter, but I like Ben."
And I said, "Okay." And she said,
"This party is so great, isn't it?"
And I said, "Yeah." Talking to a drunk person was like talking to an extremely happy, severely brain-damaged 3-year-old. Chuck Parson walked up to me just as Cassie walked away. "Jacobson," he said matter-of-factly. "Parson," I answered.
"You shaved my fucking eyebrow, didn't you?"
"I didn't shave it, actually," I said. "I used a depilatory cream." He poked me quite hard in the middle of my chest.
"You're a douche,"
he said, but he was laughing.
"That took such big balls, bro. And now you're all puppet master and shit. I mean, maybe I'm just drunk, but I'm feeling a little love for your douchey ass right now."
"Thank you," I said. I felt so detached from all this shit, all this high school is ending, so we have to reveal that deep down we all love everybody bullshit. And I imagined her at this party, or at thousands like this one, the life drawn out of her eyes. I imagined her listening to Chuck Parson babble at her and thinking about ways out, about the living ways out and the dead ways out. I could imagine the two paths with equal clarity.
"You want a beer, dick licker?"
Chuck asked. I might have forgotten he was even there, but the smell of booze on his breath made it hard to overlook his presence. I just shook my head and he wandered off. I wanted to go home, but I knew I couldn't rush Ben. This was probably the single greatest day of his life. He was entitled to it. So, instead, I found a stairway and headed down to the basement. I'd been in the dark so long, I was still craving it, and I just wanted to lie down somewhere halfway quiet and halfway dark and go back to imagining Margot. But as I walked past Becca's bedroom, I heard some muffled noises. Specifically, moanish noises, and so I paused outside her door, which was open just a crack. I could see the top 2/3 of Jace, shirtless, on top of Becca, and she had her legs wrapped around him. Nobody was naked or anything, but they were headed in that direction. And maybe a better person would have turned away, but people like me don't get a lot of chances to see people like Becca Arrington naked, so I stayed there in the doorway, peering into the room. And then they rolled around so Becca was on top of Jason, and she was sighing as she kissed him, and she was reaching down for her shirt.
"Do you think I'm hot?"
she said.
"God, yeah, you're so hot, Margo,"
Jay said.
"What?"
Becca said, furious, and it became quickly clear to me that I wasn't going to see Becca naked. She started screaming. I backed away from the door. Jay spotted me and screamed,
"What's your problem?"
And Becca shouted,
"Screw him! Who gives a shit about him? What about me? Why are you thinking about her and not me?"
That seemed like as good a time as any to take my leave of the situation, so I closed the door and went to the bathroom. I did need to pee, but mostly I just needed to be away from the human voice. It always takes a few seconds for me to start peeing after the equipment has been properly set up, and so I stood there for a second, waiting, and then I started peeing. I had just gotten to the full-stream, shudder-of-relief part of peeing when a girl's voice from the general area of the bathtub said, "Who's there?" And I said, Lacey? Quentin? What the hell are you doing here? I wanted to stop peeing, but couldn't, of course. Peeing is like a good book in that it is very, very hard to stop once you start. Peeing, I said. "How's it going?" she asked through the curtain. Fine. I shook out the last of it, zipped my shorts, and flushed. "You want to hang out in the bathtub?" she asked. "That's not a come-on." After a moment, I said, "Sure." I pulled the shower curtain back. Lacey smiled up at me, and then pulled her knees up to her chest. I sat down across from her, my back against the cold, sloping porcelain. Our feet were intertwined. She was wearing shorts and a sleeveless T-shirt and these cute little flip-flops. Her makeup was just a little smeared around her eyes. Her hair was half up, still styled for prom, and her legs were tan. It must be said that Lacey Pemberton was very beautiful. She was not the kind of girl who could make you forget about Margot Roth-Spiegelman, but she was the kind of girl who could make you forget about a lot of things. "How was prom?" I asked. "Ben is really sweet," she answered. "I had fun, but then Becca and I had a huge fight, and she called me a whore. And then she stood up on the couch upstairs, and she shushed the entire party, and then she told everyone I have an STD." I winced. "God," I said. "Yeah, I'm sort of ruined. It's just, God, it sucks, honestly, because it's just so humiliating, and she knew it would be, and it sucks. So then I went to the bathtub, and then Ben came down here, and I told him to leave me alone. Nothing against Ben, but he wasn't very good at, like, listening. He's kind of drunk. I don't even have it. I had it. It's cured. Whatever. It's just, I'm not a slut. It was one guy, one lame-ass guy. God, I can't believe I ever told her. I should have just told Margot when Becca wasn't around." "I'm sorry," I said. "The thing is that Becca is just jealous." "Why would she be jealous? She's prom queen. She's dating Chase. She's the new Margot." My butt was sore against the porcelain, so I tried to rearrange myself. My knees were touching her knees. "No one will ever be the new Margot," I said. "Anyway, you have what she really wants. People like you. People think you're cuter." Lacey shrugged bashfully. "Do you think I'm superficial?" "Well, yeah." I thought of myself standing outside Becca's bedroom, hoping she'd take her shirt off. "But so am I," I added. "So is everyone." I'd often thought, if only I had the body of Jace Worthington, walked like I knew how to walk, kissed like I knew how to kiss. "But not in the same way. Ben and I are superficial in the same way. You don't give a shit if people like you." Which was both true and not. "I care more than I'd like to," I said. "Everything sucks without Margot," she said. She was drunk, too, but I didn't mind her variety of drunk. "Yeah," I said. "I want you to take me to that place," she said. "That strip mall. Ben told me about it." "Yeah, we can go whenever you want," I said. I told her I'd been there all night, that I'd found Margot's nail polish and her blanket. Lacey was quiet for a while, breathing through her open mouth. When she finally said it, she almost whispered it, worded like a question and spoken like a statement.
"She's dead, isn't she?"
"I don't know, Lacey. I thought so until tonight, but now I don't know."
"She's dead, and we're all doing this."
I thought of the highlighted Whitman. If no other in the world be aware, I sit content. And if each and all be aware, I sit content. I said, "Maybe that's what you wanted, for life to go on."
"That doesn't sound like my Margot," she said.
And I thought of my Margot, and Lacey's Margot, and Mrs. Spiegelman's Margot, and all of us looking at her reflection in different funhouse mirrors. I was going to say something, but Lacey's open mouth became truly slack-jawed, and she leaned her head against the cold gray tile of the bathroom wall, asleep. It wasn't until after two people had come into the bathroom to pee that I decided to wake her up. It was almost 5 a.m., and I needed to take Ben home.
Lace, wake up, I said, touching her flip-flop with my shoe. She shook her head.
I like being called that, she said. You know that you're, like, currently my best friend?
I'm thrilled, I said, even though she was drunk and tired and lying. So, listen, we're going to go upstairs together, and if anybody says anything about you, I will defend your honor.
Okay,
she said. And so we went upstairs together, and the party had thinned out a little, but there were still some baseball players, including Jace, over by the keg. Mostly there were people sleeping in sleeping bags all over the floor. Some of them were squeezed onto the pull-out couch. Angela and Radar were lying together on a love seat, Radar's legs dangling over the side. They were sleeping over. Just as I was about to ask the guys by the keg if they'd seen Ben, he ran into the living room. He wore a blue baby bonnet on his head and was wielding a sword made out of 8 empty cans of Milwaukee's Best Light, which had, I assumed, been glued together.
I see you!
Ben shouted, pointing at me with the sword.
I spy Quentin Jacobson! Yes! Come here, get on your knees!
He shouted.
What? Ben, calm down.
Knees!
I obediently knelt, looking up at him. He lowered the beer sword and tapped me on each shoulder.
By the power of the super glue beer sword, I hereby designate you my driver.
Thanks, I said. Don't puke in the minivan.
Yes!
He shouted. And then, when I tried to get up, he pushed me back down with his non-beer-sworded hand, and he tapped me again with the beer sword, and he said,
By the power of the super glue beer sword, I hereby announce you'll be naked under your aerobic graduations.
What? I stood then.
Yes! Me and you and Radar, naked under our robes at graduation. It will be so awesome!
Well, I said, it will be really hot.
Yes,
he said.
Swear you will do it. I already made Radar swear. Radar, didn't you swear?
Radar turned his head ever so slightly and opened his eyes a slit.
I swore,
he mumbled. Well, then I swear too, I said.
Yes!
Then Ben turned to Lacey.
I love you.
I love you too, Ben.
No, I love you. Not like a sister loves a brother or like a friend loves a friend. I love you like a really drunk guy loves the best girl ever.
She smiled. I took a step forward, trying to save him from further embarrassment, and placed a hand on his shoulder. If we're going to get you home by 6, we should be leaving, I said.
Okay,
he said.
I just got to thank Becca for this awesome party.
So Lacey and I followed Ben downstairs, where he opened the door to Becca's room and said,
Your party kicked so much ass, even though you suck so much. It's like, instead of blood, your heart pumps liquid suck, but thanks for the beer.
Becca was alone, lying on top of her covers, staring at the ceiling. She didn't even glance over at him. She just mumbled,
Oh, go to hell, shitface. I hope your dad gives you her crabs.
Without a hint of irony in his voice, Ben answered,
Great talking to you.
And then closed the door. I don't think he had the faintest idea he had just been insulted. And then we were upstairs again and getting ready to walk out the door. Ben, I said, you're going to have to leave the beer sword here.
Right,
he said, and then I grabbed the sword's tip and tugged, but Ben refused to relinquish it. I was about to start screaming at his drunk ass when I realized he couldn't let go of the sword. Lacey laughed.
Ben, did you glue yourself to the beer sword?
No,
Ben answered.
I superglued. That way no one can steal it from me.
Good thinking, Lacey deadpanned. Lacey and I managed to break off all the beer cans except the one that was superglued directly to Ben's hand. No matter how hard I pulled, Ben's hand just limply followed along, like the beer was the string and his hand the puppet. Finally, Lacey just said,
We gotta go.
So we did. We strapped Ben into the back seat of the minivan. Lacey sat next to him because...
I should make sure he doesn't puke or beat himself to death with his beer hand or whatever.
But he was far enough gone for Lacey to feel comfortable talking about him. As I drove down the interstate, she said,
There's something to be said for trying hard, you know? I mean,
I know he tries too hard, but why is that such a bad thing? And he is sweet, isn't he? I guess so, I said. Ben's head was lolling around, seemingly unconnected to a spine. He didn't strike me as particularly sweet, but whatever. I dropped Lacey off first on the other side of Jefferson Park. When Lacey leaned over and pecked him on the mouth, he perked up enough to mumble,
"Yes."
She walked up to the driver's side door on the way to her condo.
"Thanks,"
she said. I just nodded. I drove across the subdivision. It wasn't night, and it wasn't morning. Ben snored quietly in the back. I pulled up in front of his house, got out, opened the sliding door of the minivan, and unfastened his seatbelt.
"Time to go home, Benners."
He sniffed and shook his head, then awoke. He reached up to rub his eyes and seemed surprised to find an empty can of Milwaukee's Best Light attached to his right hand. He tried to make a fist and dented the can some, but did not dislodge it. He looked at it for a minute and then nodded.
"The beast is stuck to me," he noted.
He climbed out of the minivan and staggered up the sidewalk to his house, and when he was standing on the front porch, he turned around, smiling. I waved at him. The beer waved back. Chapter 14. I slept for a few hours and spent the morning poring over the travel guides I'd discovered the day before. I waited until noon to call Ben and Radar. I called Ben first.
"Good morning, sunshine,"
I said.
"Oh, God,"
Ben said, his voice dripping abject misery.
"Oh, sweet baby Jesus, come and comfort your little bro Ben. Oh, Lord, shower me with your mercy."
"There have been a lot of Margot developments," I said excitedly, "so you need to come over. I'm going to call Radar, too." Ben seemed not to have heard me.
Hey, when my mom came into my room at 9 o'clock this morning, why is it that as I reached up to yawn, she and I both discovered a beer can was stuck to my hand?
You superglued a bunch of beers together to make a beer sword, and then you superglued your hand to it.
Oh, yeah, the beer sword. That rings a bell.
Ben, come over.
Bro, I feel like shit.
Then I'll come over to your house. How soon?
Bro, you can't come over here. I have to sleep for 10,000 hours. I have to drink 10,000 gallons of water and take 10,000 Advils. I'll just see you tomorrow at school.
I took a deep breath and tried not to sound pissed.
I drove across Central Florida in the middle of the night to be sober at the world's drunkest party and drive your soggy ass home, and this is...
I would have kept talking, but I noticed that Ben had hung up. He hung up on me, asshole. As time passed, I only got more pissed. It's one thing not to give a shit about Margot, but really, Ben didn't give a shit about me either. Maybe our friendship had always been about convenience. He didn't have anyone cooler than me to play video games with. And now he didn't have to be nice to me or care about the things I cared about because he had Jace Worthington. He had the school keg stand record. He had a hot prom date. He'd jumped at his first opportunity to join the fraternity of vapid asshats. 5 minutes after he hung up on me, I called his cell again. He didn't answer, so I left a message.
"You want to be cool like Chuck Bloody Ben? That's what you always wanted? Well, congratulations. You got it. And you deserve him, because you're also a shitbag. Don't call back."
Then I called Radar.
"Hey,"
I said.
"Hey," he answered. "I just threw up in the shower. Can I call you back?"
"Sure," I said, trying not to sound angry.
I just wanted someone to help me sort through the world according to Margot.
But Radar wasn't Ben. He called me back just a couple minutes later.
"It was so disgusting that I puked while cleaning it up, and then while cleaning that up, I puked again. It's like a perpetual motion machine. If you just kept feeding me, I could have just kept puking forever."
"Can you come over, or can I come over to your house?"
"Yeah, of course. What's up?"
Margot was alive and in the mini-mall for at least one night after her disappearance.
"I'll come to you. 4 minutes."
Radar showed up at my window precisely 4 minutes later. "You should know I'm having a huge fight with Ben," I said as he climbed in.
"I'm too hungover to mediate,"
Radar answered quietly. He lay down on the bed, his eyes half-closed, and rubbed his buzzed hair.
"It's like I got hit by lightning,"
he sniffed.
"Okay, bring me up to date."
I sat down in the desk chair and told Radar about my evening in Margot's vacation house, trying hard not to leave out any possible helpful details. I knew Radar was better at puzzles than I, and I was hoping he'd pieced together this one. He waited to talk until I'd said, "And then Ben called me and I left for that party."
"Do you have that book, the one with the turned-down corners?"
he asked. I got up and fished for it under the bed, finally pulling it out. Radar held it above his head, squinting through his headache, and flipped through the pages.
"Write this down," he said. "Omaha, Nebraska, Sac City, Iowa, Alexandria, Indiana, Darwin, Minnesota, Hollywood, California, Alliance, Nebraska. Okay. Those are the locations of all the things she, well, or whoever read this book, found interesting."
He got up, motioned me out of the chair, and then swiveled to the computer. Radar had an amazing talent for carrying on conversations while typing.
"There's a map mashup that allows you to enter multiple destinations, and it will spit out a variety of itineraries. Not that you'd know about this program, but still, I want to see."
"How do you know all this shit?" I asked.
Reminder, I spend my entire life on Omnictionary. In the hour between when I got home this morning and when I hurled in the shower, I completely rewrote the page for the blue-spotted anglerfish. I have a problem." "Okay, look at this," he said.
I leaned in and saw several jagged routes drawn onto a map of the United States. All began in Orlando and ended in Hollywood, California.
"Maybe she'll stay in L.A., Radar suggested.
"Maybe," I said. "There's no way to tell her route, though."
"True. Also, nothing else points to L.A. What she said to Jace points to New York. The go-to-the-paper towns and never come back points to a nearby pseudo-vision, it seems. The nail polish also points to maybe her still being in the area. I'm just saying, we can now add the location of the world's largest ball of popcorn to our list of possible Margot locales."
The traveling would fit with one of the Whitman quotes, "I tramp a perpetual journey." Radar stayed hunched over the computer. I went to sit down on the bed. "Hey, will you just print out a map of the U.S. so I can plot the points?" I asked.
"I can just do it online," he said. "Yeah, but I want to be able to look at it."
The printer fired up a few seconds later, and I placed the U.S. map next to the one with the pseudovisions on the wall. I put a tack in for each of the six locations she, or someone, had marked in the book. I tried to look at them as a constellation to see if they formed a shape or a letter, but I couldn't see anything. It was a totally random distribution, like she'd blindfolded herself and thrown darts at the map. I sighed.
"You know it would be nice," Radar asked, "if we could find some evidence that she was checking her email or anywhere on the Internet. I search for her name every day. I've got a bot that will alert me if she ever logs on to Omnictionary with that username. I track IP addresses of people who search for the phrase paper towns. It's incredibly frustrating."
"I didn't know you were doing all that stuff," I said.
"Yeah, well, only doing what I'd want someone else to do. I know I wasn't friends with her, but she deserves to be found, you know?"
"Unless she doesn't want to be," I said.
"Yeah, I guess that's possible. It's all still possible."
I nodded.
"Yeah, so, okay," he said. "Can we brainstorm over video games?
I'm not really in the mood."
"Can we call Ben then?"
"No, Ben's an asshole." Radar looked at me sideways.
"Of course he is. You know your problem, Quentin? You keep expecting people not to be themselves. I mean, I could hate you for being massively unpunctual and for never being interested in anything other than Margot Roth Spiegelman and for, like, never asking me about how it's going with my girlfriend. But I don't give a shit, man, because you're you. My parents have a shit ton of Black Santas, but that's okay. They're them. I'm too obsessed with a reference website to answer my phone sometimes when my friends call or my girlfriend. That's okay, too. That's me. You like me anyway, and I like you. You're funny and you're smart, and you may show up late, but you always show up eventually."
"Thanks."
"Yeah, well, I wasn't complimenting you. Just saying. Stop thinking Ben should be you, and he needs to stop thinking you should be him, and y'all just chill the hell out."
"All right," I said finally, and called Ben.
The news that Radar was over and wanted to play video games led to a miraculous hangover recovery. "So," I said after hanging up, "how's Angela?" Radar laughed. "She's good, man. She's real good. Thanks for asking." "You still a virgin?" I asked. "I don't kiss and tell. Although, yes. Oh, and we had our first fight this morning. We had breakfast at Waffle House, and she was going on about how awesome the Black Santas are and how my parents are great people